Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome to Real Jam Radio. I am Daniel Orr, your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. My guest is the great Kevin Pelton of ESPN, and we have a great conversation running through a lot of different NBA topics, the new faces and new places that we're most excited to see, the general dynamics of the East and West playoff picture, some of the situations that we're keeping an eye on, young teams, teams with something to prove, all of that. Really great conversation brought to you by betonline.ag. Use the CLNS50 promo code to get yourself a 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. Episode runs just about an hour. Lots of really good stuff in here. I hope you will enjoy it. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks, as always, for having me.
I notice, you know, especially because of this being the longest break in the year, and also with just the nature, you and I have talked about this a little bit in other places about how the All-Star game in basketball is actually pretty late in the season, that we're not setting up the second half of the season right now. We're setting up the stretch run.
Right. I mean, you know, Dan Feldman wrote about this in the Dunked On Daily Dunks on Friday as we're recording this, that this is the most games on average that have ever been played in NBA history before the All-Star game. And, you know, that really it's only basically a quarter of the season that's left now. So, yeah, it does kind of change things. We think of it as the mid-season game, the halfway point, but we are well beyond that. And really not a lot of time left for some of these new teams to integrate players, because I think that's the other element of it is, you know, obviously now the trade deadline coming before the All-Star break, and especially this year, it feels like, you know, Kyrie played maybe two games with Luka Doncic before the break. Kevin Durant obviously hasn't returned and played yet for the Phoenix Suns. So some of these big storylines coming out of the trade deadline are still unfolding.
For sure. I think of Milwaukee as another good example of this, where you now, because of the combination of the deadline and the All-Star break, there wasn't really an incentive, we don't even know how ready he would have been, to rush integrate Jay Crowder. And so instead, Jay Crowder, who hasn't played in an NBA game before the All-Star break, you get that time and you could get that adjustment. And so we are going to see different iterations. And, you know, like Nate and I did an entire pod on Thursday where a portion of it was just like, who's still hurt, who's not hurt? You know, those sorts of elements, because you get... It's actually one of the bigger clarifiers that happens is, you know, sometimes player X will be out through the All-Star break, but it's like, well, would he have come back earlier in that, or are they still out? Like, you know, various different players with their maladies. Zion, unfortunately, suffered a re-injury. And that kind of lends itself to I think the biggest story that we're going to be looking for over these next 2 weeks. It's often a sort of thing that I end podcasts with, is just, what are we going to be watching? And I think it's new faces in new places.
Yeah, that's always like the trade deadline, you know, that period afterwards. It's kind of like you start the season anew, because, you know, there's so much interest in how is this player going to look with their new team? How are they going to be used? How is it going to be different? How is it going to be the same? Whereas I will admit that, you know, when we get to mid-January, the NBA viewing can maybe seem a little more monotonous because there's not that degree of mystery about teams.
Right. And I think that I didn't develop as full an appreciation for this until recently, not only with the trade deadline, but also buyouts largely occurring during the same window too. Technically speaking, players can still be bought out until March 1st and play for their new teams in the playoffs. But we're seeing those movements happen early. So, you know, this is going to be Russell Westbrook on the Clippers, Kevin Love on the Heat, all of those circumstances. So it's not only the trade deadline guys, especially with some of the injury-related delays for players like Durant, but it's that. And so we're going to see closer, in many cases, unfortunately not for the Bucks, to full-strength iterations of these teams coming out of the break, which is extremely exciting.
Definitely. You mentioned the crowd. I think it's interesting because it does stand in contrast to the comparison that was kind of natural that I used when he got traded was Andre Iguodala sitting out the pre-trade deadline portion of the season that he spent with the Memphis Grizzlies and alienated their young players in the process. And you know, I was there for his first game with the Heat, which happened to be in Portland, and it was like the Sunday after the trade deadline. So it's interesting they took a very different approach, Milwaukee, and you know, I guess you have the luxury of doing that when you're on what a 12 game winning streak.
Sure. And they, you know, I think it was just the idea of, well, where is he going to fit in and everything else like that. And the East is a fascinating place to start because I think there's more clarity depending on how interesting you find the bottom of the playoff picture. I think that there happens to be some separation preliminarily. We'll see health and everything else between like the 10th and 11th spots, depending on what happens with the Bulls. The Pacers lost again, though they were close to the end against the Celtics. And the idea there being like with the success that Washington has had recently, my instinct right now is that we know that we have a pretty good idea of who the 10 teams that will be competing in the postseason are. But getting that to 8 and then, of course, getting out of the first round and the first round itself are going to be fascinating.
Yeah, 538 currently has a 3-game separation between Washington's average finish of 40-42 and Chicago at 37-45. And, you know, not that it was any surprise, but we did learn officially during the break that Lonzo Ball is not going to be able to come back and help fill some of the needs for Chicago. They do have their own new buyout player in Patrick Beverley, and we'll see how much he helps them. But I think there is a little more clarity, and it's more about jockeying within those spots. The one that looms is potentially, I think, the most important would be Philadelphia and Cleveland 3-4. And the game that we've already seen coming out of the break Thursday night, the Sixers coming back to beat the Grizzlies, pretty important there because, you know, there was a period of time with the Sixers' difficult schedule, the remaining 20 games, that it looked like maybe they, you know, slide down to 4, despite the fact that they've got a pretty good cushion on Cleveland in the standings. But, you know, the last night's results have helped you give Philadelphia a more comfortable advantage on third there.
On that point, generally speaking, this far out, scheduling strength does matter, and especially in some ways the weaker teams you're playing, like, because I think at this point most teams are still trying, other than if they've already kind of ransacked their roster. Philadelphia, but what you look for are the extremes. Philadelphia has the hardest remaining strength of schedule if you're just factoring in opponent winning percentage. Per Tankathon, it's 53.7% opponents have won of their games. And then just as coincidence happened after last night's game, because Cleveland faced the Nuggets, Cleveland has the easiest remaining strength of schedule, 47.2%. Now, there's a lot of context, as you know, that is not included within that. But why the 3-4 matters so much is because of who you face. Now, maybe certain circumstances, those teams wouldn't want to face, you know, like maybe you'd rather have the Bucks or the Celtics. Not that we know necessarily who's going to be the 1 seed or the 2 seed right now. But it probably gives you a significantly easier first round matchup as well, preliminarily.
I mean, I guess actually that's where maybe it has flipped since the trade deadline. I hadn't really thought about this until I'm looking at it now is, you know, before it was the idea of, well, there's this big 5 in the East and a separation from them to everyone else. And Brooklyn was part of that group. Now Brooklyn is intriguing as that team is now, is the group of, you know, highly switchable 3-and-D role players with a handful of players at either side of the positional spectrum. No longer, you know, I think you'd probably rather face them in the first round than you would Miami, and we're still kind of not sure how those are going to shake out 5 and 6 because Brooklyn's, you know, spot in 5th is no longer as secure, and then you've got Boston and Milwaukee could flip-flop 1st and 2nd. So I don't know, maybe as I look at it 3rd and 4th, it's too early to say whether it really matters. You might actually rather be in 4th in some ways than 3rd.
We may find out in time. The one consideration that I would mention there, and Brooklyn does, as we're recording this, have a 3-game advantage in the loss column. For teams that are at the higher end, I look at the loss column because you can make up the wins, and then it's the reverse for the bottom. And so what you could see now that Brooklyn isn't as formidable is the team in the 5 is just the team that's playing the best over this last 20 right. some odd games. And so I don't think that team is going to be as good as the full strength version of the Nets would have been, but you do still run into that. And there's the variance with injuries. Maybe a team is playing the best, but they have something else. And the incentives, and it's also with 3-4, you're probably not gaining, you're gaining a theoretically more favorable matchup in the first round and potentially in the second, depending on how you feel about the two versus the one. But you're not necessarily gaining more home court series unless there are significant upsets.
Well, let's talk about that Boston-Milwaukee situation at the top. Maybe that's where we should have started. It's interesting because despite the fact that the Bucks are on this 12-game winning streak, again, as we record coming out of the All-Star break, they still haven't come close to catching Boston in point differential. In fact, they're still last among the top four teams in the East in point differential, with Cleveland being the underachievers in the standings relative to their differential, and Milwaukee still pretty massively overachieving. Should we be worried about that, or is it just irrelevant because they've played well enough with Chris Middleton healthy?
It's relevant. However, that becomes superseded by the players they've had missing. You know, so the idea, basically, the record overstates how well they've played or how well they played so far, but you expect them to play better is right. Probably. And so, and for me, generally speaking, especially if you're consolidating to a playoff rotation, then I have belief that the Bucks can be better than they have been so far. And it was looking like, especially with that win streak, that Milwaukee could really put a little bit of a charge into Boston. I mean, Boston has a lot of talent. They've also, you know, had some injuries, though not nearly to the extent of the Milwaukee Bucks. And so you kind of thought maybe that could shake out. Now, we don't know timing on Giannis. It sounds like he's going to play whenever he's not feeling pain. I'm guessing that's not going to be super long, but considering where Boston, like what they've done and how good they are, it is going to be hard. It is going to be harder for the Bucks to pass them than I expected going into the break.
Definitely. That changed the equation. It feels like on Boston that people just kind of, because of the fact that they started so strong and, you know, then had kind of a middling December and have, you know, just been going on, they played well, but not as well as they did at the start. And it's kind of, our attention has been distracted elsewhere. It's Denver's rise in the Western Conference standings. It's now the new faces in the Western Conference. You know, can Phoenix be the favorites there? What's happening with the Clippers? That, like, Boston is flying relatively under the radar for a team that has, you know, both the best record and pretty solidly the best point differential in the NBA.
It is a weird thing that happens because, like, I mean, sometimes for individual players, I don't know why the name Jeff Teague always sticks in my head. There's this idea that if a player shoots really well in the beginning of the season, you kind of think they're shooting well the whole year, and then because you don't check the numbers every week. In some ways, it's the opposite, like, because we're watching teams more frequently and kind of thinking about them in the micro and the macro, where that dominance early, it does fade a little bit. And some of it was, I mean, I always caution people. It's like, this is the best. So far, they've been this best ever. It's like, well, that's because you had a smaller sample. There's more prone to variance and everything like that. And Boston had this ridiculous first shot half court offense at the very beginning of the season. That toned down. Oh, whoop-de-doo, they're still second in the league in offense overall. And for Boston, I think the other part, yes, they added Malcolm Brogdon, that makes things different, is we largely know what they are. We largely know what the sales pitch, and that undersells the improvement that players like Jason Tatum have made. And Jaylen Brown's had some improvements too. Still, the theory of the case for the Celtics to me is basically the same, and they won the Eastern Conference last year and had a reasonable shot of winning the finals, of course.
The disrespect to Mike Muscala has been noted, and it is not appreciated. I mean, in fairness, the Celtics are still the, you know, Vegas championship favorites at this point. It just feels like relatively the conversation has moved away from them in recent weeks. And maybe that's just a case of us paying attention to whatever, you know, kind of the new thing is, the new toy is, as opposed to our old familiar favorite.
I'll throw you a question that came up in actually a Dunked On Prime Discord recently. I think it was in the last chat I did, talking about the teams in the West and championship odds and all that. And what I was saying is, I think the West overall, the strength is a little bit underappreciated, in part because some of these teams have been so injured. But my expectation right now is that the NBA champion will come out of the East. And what makes this hard is that the West is going to be a bloodbath, and whatever team makes it out will be playing really well at that time. But I think, knowing what I know right now, I fully expect to be convinced otherwise by June. But I think I'd pick, knowing what we know right now, I'd pick the Celtics or the Bucks in a series, a final series, against whoever comes out of the West. Do you agree with that concept?
I do. It's interesting. So again, the odds have the East is like a tiny favorite over the West. I'm adding up the totals on 538 and on championship odds, and that seems to have it almost exactly 50-50. I mean, the one thing about this is because of the fact that the West is probably somewhat deeper than the East, whoever emerges out of that will have had a pretty impressive playoff run, accepting injuries that make that run easier than it looks right now, which I guess we probably can accept at this point in NBA history. So from that standpoint, again, if Phoenix crushes Denver in the conference finals, let's say, then maybe the situation looks a lot different. But right now, I do tend to agree that I still think the two strongest bets to win the title, the two teams in a tier by themselves, are Boston and Milwaukee, because of the fact that A, they are two of the three best teams right now, and B, we've seen them both do it at a high level in the postseason. The Bucks when they won the title 2 years ago, and the Celtics and making it to the finals last year.
I agree with that. I posited a very similar idea. I also am concerned. I mean, various, whoever makes it out of that Western Conference is going to be nasty, but there is a part of me that's like, that is just thinking, are you going to feel really stupid that you were underappreciating Denver? Because when they've had their best guys available, they've been great. Jokic is unbelievable. They still have some of that, though. I mean, they were, you could argue, and I believe that was 2020 when they acquired Aaron Gordon. Was that 21, where they were like the best team in the league for six games and then Jamal Murray got hurt?
Yep, 21.
And so there's a part of me that thinks that, but the larger element is just they have some really good defenders, and I think this is their best roster and best constructed, balanced, all that stuff. I think Malone has done a very nice job this year. The questions about whether they can defend the best teams are still present. And Denver, they haven't made an NBA Finals. They have made a conference finals. They could have theoretically even made a second one during Jokic's tenure. They've still, even in some of those series that they've won, they've had some shaky defensive performances too. And I think it's so weird to parallel them with Cleveland, because Denver has had more success in this iteration than the Cavs had, because the Cavs, this iteration is basically just new. But the idea that I'll believe it when I see it, and I distinctly could see it, but I'm not all the way there yet. Fair or unfair?
Yeah, to me, it's more like, and it's weird because I don't think the Nuggets have underachieved in the playoffs. I mean, certainly the 2020 run was significantly overachieving in the playoffs. But to me, the comparison is more of a team like, Toronto during the late 2010s, where it's like, it doesn't matter how good a regular season you have. I need to see you do it in the playoffs to fully buy in. And I'm accepting with that I'm kind of in the same boat as you on the Nuggets, and that we might go down with this ship. They might blow through the Western Conference playoffs, and it's like, yeah, obviously they were the best team. They had the best record in the West by, I think, currently five games, maybe five and a half now. They have the two-time MVP. They've experienced more playoff success than a lot of the teams that are at the top of the Western Conference standings, with Phoenix is maybe the exception to that. That in hindsight, maybe it should have been obvious that they were going to make it all along. But I still feel the same way, that even though we've seen pieces here and there, Zach Lowe has liked to bring up of them employing different defensive strategies and, being a little more creative to take Nikola Jokic out of the pick and roll. I still, when we get to the very highest levels of competition, which hopefully we'll be able to get to in this year's Western Conference playoffs, hopefully health will permit that, then I think those weaknesses might be magnified in a way that they just aren't going to be over the 82-game regular season. And then the other element with Denver is, so much of their success, as it always is driven by playing really well at home, 27-4 at home, basically a 500 team on the road. It does feel like there's some degree to which that doesn't entirely translate to the postseason.
I believe I saw something years ago that the two teams that have persistent home court advantages, kind of irrespective of their quality year to year, are the Denver Nuggets and the Utah Jazz, the two teams that play at highest elevations. And it makes sense that that would tone down, because in part, other than the very end of a series, you're never playing there on the tail end of a back-to-back, and you're often playing two games, so you have more time to acclimate and everything else. So it makes intuitive sense that that home court would be less extreme. And Denver also, like, as great as they are offensively, they've done a great job against great teams. They haven't fully solved the non-Jokic minutes, even though they've gotten better, and those minutes will hopefully be very few in the playoffs. One of the things that gives me pause, and I thought this might be a worthwhile exercise for us, is just, as much as I think a lot of these Western Conference teams deserve respect, and I mean, you can argue some of it, I don't think there's a team out there, in some part because of the defensive deficiencies of some of these squads, that is just an obvious, like, oh, if they put it together, they're kryptonite for any good team. Like, you know, that I'm not talking about like the absolute best case. I'm talking about like the reasonable best case scenarios for some of these teams.
I still think Phoenix can be that team. I mean, they don't have necessarily that one wing defender, but they also don't have, you know, a lot of terrible defenders. We'll see how much Chris Paul's just height at this age is a weakness for him in the playoffs. If, you know, teams have started to hunt him in a way that would have been unimaginable when you think back to when Chris Paul defended Kevin Durant as like the primary defender back in that Clippers Thunder series, whatever year that was. So I think I'm higher on the realistic best case scenario for the Suns, although I'm granting that there are many reasons, health primary among them, but we might not see that group this year.
There's also the question about, like, so I've thought a lot about a Memphis-Denver series, and I have this distinct feeling right now that if that's the Western Conference Finals, we'll have a very clear idea within two games, but I'm not exactly sure which idea is going to take hold. And so, like, for that series, it's, you know, how are they going to contain Ja Morant? Desmond Bane could end up being a big difference maker. But also, Jokic has generally, as I recall it, done very well against Steven Adams in his career, and this collection of Grizzlies bigs that are very good, and I think are you know, can fill a lot of gaps. Jokic creates more gaps than they fill most of the time, and so how those two teams square up, should it end up getting there, and I mean, it's another real challenge to kind of assess.
Friend of the pod David Locke told me last night to look up Memphis's like net rating by quarter, which is not something I had done until just now, and it is pretty ghastly for the fourth quarter. They are -5.9 in the fourth quarter. The only
had a rough one Thursday.
I sure did. The only two teams they are ahead of are the Houston Rockets and the San Antonio Spurs. That is wild. I don't know if I've ever seen a split like that for a good team.
That's stunning.
Denver is also negative in the fourth quarter, although that one makes a lot more sense because obviously Jokic, you know, typically plays the entire first and third and is resting a good portion of the fourth quarter. So I don't know if that's as indicative of a weakness for them, but I having just learned of this information, I'm not yet sure how to process it.
If we're narrowing it just to clutch situations, so that means, you know, within 5 points within the last 5 minutes, Memphis, -12.8 net rating. Only 73 clutch minutes. I believe that's the fewest in the league. Yes, it is. That is the fewest in the league. San Antonio is actually second in that stat. That explains the two ways that you cannot have a lot of clutch time. And they're 13-12 in those games, which is not fantastic, for especially for a team this good, though, you know, being significantly under. And the reasoning, if you want to kind of work through it, is they're 20th in offense, but fascinatingly, they're 26th in defense during that time. I don't think the splits with and without Jaren Jackson available, like, we're already cutting it pretty thin here. We're talking 73 minutes, but that is really striking. I hadn't really fully thought about that. And for reference, the next team that I think has real championship equity, unless you want to count the Sacramento Kings, on that, like, let's say clutch defensive rating.
You're going to get the tweets from Sacramento.
Oh,
now.
I always get the tweets from Sacramento. Is Phoenix. Phoenix is 22nd, 114.5 in clutch defensive rating.
Yeah, and then Denver is at, it's amusing that it's Phoenix, by the way, given their dominance in that stat last season.
Right.
Denver is at the other extreme, at +22 in net rating in clutch situations. I mean, I think the one thing you worry about a lot is the way that NBA stats defines it. You know, oftentimes a lot of the possessions you're counting are kind of meaningless possessions. Like, it's, I'm fouling to get the ball back, or, you know, I'm trying to score down five with 30 seconds left, that may not really reflect the actual kind of ability in those situations. That's one of the things I'd like to do, is put together my play-by-play data to the point where I can kind of parse out those situations and only talk about, like, here are the legitimate possessions in clutch situations. And then the other element, of course, is you're just getting down down to a tiny sample size. So surprisingly, opponent 3-point percentage is not a big part of that. It doesn't look like, unless the opponents are hitting 35% against Memphis in clutch situations, which is 23rd, 36% against Phoenix, which is 24th. But it's not like off the charts numbers. Like Atlanta is giving up 42% somehow in clutch situations, which will affect those ratings pretty significantly.
If you narrow the requirements to within 3 points, 3 points or fewer, the margin, and 3 minutes or less on the time, Memphis drops to it's only 34 minutes. They drop to a negative 30 net rating, which is second worst in the league behind the Atlanta Hawks, ahead of the Atlanta Hawks only. So it's you could, and it's funny, there are actually a lot of good teams in that range. And as Seth Partnow brings up, there are a lot of different ways that you can get into those circumstances. But if it's within three, that's kind of one of the things I like about narrowing it every once in a while. It's like, it's harder to get those, like, you dip in for a second and then are back out. Like, if a game is within three, within the final 3 minutes, it was probably competitive at some point towards the end.
Yeah, it's definitely competitive. It's just those, like, kind of fake possessions that concern me.
Oh, and I love that you brought up that point, though, overall, because when you're already cutting the slices so thin, the elements that compose that remaining slice could end up be like variability, small randomness could end up playing just a huge part of it.
Exactly. Yeah. This is one of kind of, I think, the persistent tensions in statistical analysis is that people really like the idea that the sample is the most representative it possibly can be. So, you know, let's look at how teams performed against playoff teams as opposed to against all teams or something like that. And in general, what you find working with the data is the larger sample is actually usually still a better predictor than getting rid of data to make it more representative.
Especially because there are all these other factors that can be in play for, you know, as you narrow it down. Maybe one of the games you played against a team over 500, the player who drives their success wasn't available. And so then all of a sudden that gets in there. And that was something I've pushed at various moments of time. And I think Darko, the people who do Darko are doing this, of like player availability adjusted net rating, where it's just like, so if this person who makes that team good was unavailable in that specific game, and it all comes back to this idea of context. And it's like, what we're trying to figure out here is what is relevant, what isn't. And that, you know, like, it's so challenging in this year's West to figure out, because in part because of some of the context situations that have been there. Like the Clippers are a fantastic team to talk about with this, where it's like, well, what is this team? And in part, it's because even when their players have been available, the sample's still a little bit weird. Or like the Warriors. I mean, the Warriors, part of the story is that especially Steph Curry hasn't been around as much as they would like. But also, they've been, generally speaking, if memory serves, worse when he's been on the floor than he would like too.
Well, it's that starting lineup has still been so strong, and that's, it feels like what kind of the Warriors believers are hanging on to. And I've been kind of surprised after the trade deadline how many people are still picking the Warriors to win the West. I get it from the standpoint of, we just talked about, you know, with the Nuggets and some other West teams, that it's like, I want to actually see it happen in the playoffs before I believe it can happen. And we've all seen it happen with the Warriors. We've seen it repeatedly. We've seen it as recently as last year with a similar cast to this, and even more similar one, assuming that they get Gary Payton II back in time for the postseason. And yet, like, last night's loss dropped them to 10th in the West. I at some point, this run has got to come. Like, this run that we all keep expecting them to have has got to come, and they're running out of runway for it. Because again, speaking in terms of, I got to see it before I can believe it, someone coming all the way through the play-in, I think that scenario is just wildly overrated. That it's one of those things you talk yourself into, like, no one's going to want to face them. They're a scary team on paper. And it's like, yes, that's true. But at some point, the number of games, the difficulty, the fact that you probably dealt with some injuries, and that's why you got stuck in the play-in, whether you're the Warriors or, you know, if it's this year's Lakers, the 2021 Lakers were a great example of this. Eventually, I think that's probably going to catch up with you, and probably sooner rather than later.
This could be the anomalous year, but my general thought has been there are a number of teams that could be 6 seed or worse that I could see winning a series, but seeing them winning the whole conference would be stunning, because it doesn't happen very often for a reason. And it could very well be that there are some of those big upsets early. People are like, oh, look, it's wide open, it's the Wild West and all that type of stuff. And then things normalize within it. And that, I mean, a couple pieces of context on that from the Warriors front. Right now, Golden State, so last year, 10.6 cleaning the glass, plus 10.6 cleaning the glass net rating when Steph Curry was on the floor. This year, plus 6.3. And they're 20-18 in games when Stephen Curry plays. Like, that is below the standard. And that's not because Steph Curry has been bad. Far from it. But the team overall hasn't quite been there. And there have been other injuries. But, like, that 20-18 isn't good enough for them to sustain all of these different levels. And as you brought up, like, there have been times where it feels like, oh, the run might be coming now. And then they just, like, have a complete dud out there. And it's hard. Picking them to win the West, I think, is very ambitious. Picking them to win an individual series, I firmly believe that Styles makes fights and all of that. And that's why it's going to be so fascinating to see where this shakes out, like, in terms of where teams end up. Because, like, I mean, Sacramento, it's a wonderful success story. Their offense is going to give everybody challenges. They are crushing bad teams in part because of that. And that Mike Brown, Sabonis, everybody deserves a ton of credit for that. I'm still skeptical of them as a playoff team. But if they're, like, the three, if they hang on there, if they're the four, A, that puts them in much better position to win a series. We don't know who they'd be facing and everything else. But also, that means that a team, let's say the Clippers or the Warriors, presumably is coming from behind more. And that is going to be a different challenge.
I mean, it feels like there's going to be just such urgency to get that sixth seed from the standpoint of, number one, if Sacramento stays three, because number one, you stay out of the play-in, obviously, which everyone is going to want to do, have that time off and just not have the risk of falling all the way out. And then two, also the opportunity to play Sacramento in the first round, is opposed to getting Denver or Memphis, presumably. Like, that's a pretty wide gap. And I feel like that, I don't know what the record is for, like, the number of, you know, the pre-series predictions favoring the team without home court advantage in a 3-6 matchup, but I feel like it is in strong jeopardy if Sacramento stays there, with all due respect to the Kings.
It would be the equivalent of that 5-12 in the NCAA tournament that seems like everybody picks, and those actually cash out fairly frequently, so I don't know the exact numbers on that. Plenty more to discuss with Kevin Pelton, but first a message from betonline.ag. BetOnline remains your number one source for all your sports betting this season, everything from pro and college basketball, UFC, MMA, NHL, and more. You'll always find the latest odds, team matchup information, player news, game trends at BetOnline. With live betting options, free contests, and live scores for almost any sport or game imaginable, BetOnline is truly the fastest and easiest way to bet all your favorite leagues and events. So head to the website today or use your mobile device and use the promo code CLNS50 to receive your 50% welcome bonus with your first deposit. Again, make sure to use the promo code CLNS50 to receive your rewards at betonline.ag, where the game starts. So we've talked a little bit about the Suns here. Let's do, like, a reasonable best case scenario. I'm not asking you to get into the statistical analysis. This is going to be more about your feel on it. Let's exclude the Nuggets, the Grizzlies, and the Suns, in part because we've talked about them. Realistic best case, so not 100th percentile outcome, let's say 90th, 85th, something in that range. Who do you think is the most dangerous? You can count seed if you want, however you want to do it from that point.
I guess it's probably still the Clippers, right? Like,
I'm angry with myself, but yeah, I think it is.
I already feel tremendous regret for picking the Clippers to win the West coming into the season, and not going with a safer bet on that count. But again, you know, we've seen that their small ball lineups can cause teams a lot of problems in the playoffs. I mean, the Westbrook scenario factor is the biggest possible wild card, and maybe the biggest reason, aside from the fact that they just haven't been very good this season, that I hesitate in saying that. But again, there's a level that they can get to when Kawhi Leonard is, you know, at the top of his game, and he's looked pretty close to it, I think, for an extended period of time here. So that they're my reluctant pick.
They also have different theories of the case, which is very useful. I mean, so the Warriors have the benefit of, like, we know that their theory of the case can work, especially if they can get something out of Iguodala. Andrew Wiggins' absences this year have been definitely unusual for him. So you have those elements working in their favor. And with the Clippers, it's always been, you know, like, as much as we, like, Zach Lowe, and I agree with him that the Nets are that, like, ultimate theoretical team, in some ways the Clippers are too, because they have had a couple of really good series, and they also got beat basically full strength with a different coach against the Nuggets in 2020, and full credit to Denver for winning that. And so
But now Mason Plumlee's on the other side.
Yes, yes, and that has swung the full tide. And I wonder, because this comes up a lot in the context of player injuries, of just like the passage of time. And so it's like, you know, the Kawhi Leonard that we're going to see right now is not the Kawhi Leonard that we saw before the injury, even if he had never gotten hurt. Like, that's just the way aging works, the way the passage of time works. And so there's a part of me that goes, do they still have that fastball? I'm still, you know, it's kind of that, it's the reverse of the believe it when you see it sort of element, is like, I've seen it, at least with some of these players individually. And there also is the element, I'm looking it up, but when Kawhi Leonard has been on the floor, they have a plus 8.1 net rating. That's actually worse than 2 years ago, but that's still pretty dang good. And there's a big part of me that goes, haven't you been down this road and been wrong so many times before? Why do you think it's going to be different? And I think part of it is also that I don't have as much faith, you know, like, so the Mavs, I think their defensive woes are a version of catastrophic against really, really good teams. I think they're that, you know, wild card, cut the brakes, like, they can beat anybody, but they can also lose to anybody type of team. Like Sacramento, they have some things that I really like, but they don't really have the personnel for a team like the Clippers. And I think the Clippers have reasonable personnel for them. And like, there have been versions of the Wolves that I've liked better, but I think in some ways that is about, it's a statement of how I don't trust anybody else more than I think the Clippers are amazing.
Exactly. You know, I hadn't thought about this. It's still unlikely, I think, that probably Phoenix will scuttle this somehow, but we could have another Clippers Mavericks first round series for the third time in 4 years.
I really don't want that to happen, in part because I want to see, well, you got to see Luka a little further last year, but getting new matchups. The other team, even though I think this, particularly with Zion's hamstring stuff, isn't going to be the best iteration of them, I think there's a chance that the Pelicans put a charge into this. And maybe they're more in the, especially with these losses in the Clippers-Warriors camp, of can beat a lot of teams, but probably won't win the whole conference this year. If they can get this moving to the point, like, if Zion's playing defense like he was before, they have a lot of functional depth. I thought Willie Green generally did a nice job putting players in positions to succeed. The losses have really made it harder for me to like pick them in different series, but they could be really feisty and dangerous.
I also wonder to what degree it informed their thinking going into the trade deadline. When we did the Dunked On mock trade deadline, I had the Pelicans and was definitely, you know, trying to get into the OG Anunoby conversations and, you know, ended up dealing for Miles Turner, even though we couldn't make the renegotiate and sign and trade happen. Renegotiate and extend and sign and trade, I guess. It makes sense that they would be a little less ambitious now that it looks like they're going to have a hard time getting out of the play-in tournament. So you don't necessarily want to expend some of that draft capital on a season where you're unlikely to have a long run. But yeah, I mean, look, the version of them, we barely seen them with both Zion and Brandon Ingram healthy. The version that we saw with just Zion was already pretty good. And they could be the proverbial team that you don't want to see coming out of the play-in tournament as well.
They could be. And even though I have skepticism about how their talent meshes and, you know, where's the ball going to go? How are they going to do it defensively? Like, and, you know, where does Valanciunas fit in and Ingram and Zion and so many different things? There are always teams. And there was an iteration of the Brooklyn Nets that looked like this, where it's like those parts don't matter because you just can't stop them in the first place. And so you don't have to worry about it. And they have enough team defenders and everything else. And that kind of lends itself. You brought up the idea of draft capital, and I think now we're past the trade deadline. One of the key storylines that I'm going to be watching over the next year, so meaning from now until the 2024 trade deadline, is we have this group of teams. Specifically, I'll focus on the Pelicans, the Oklahoma City Thunder, and the Utah Jazz, who are simultaneously some version of competitive. We'll see where this Jazz post-Conley stuff ends up, and the Thunder, some definitely worth watching, all of them. All of them, if they want to, could be important bidders in whatever level of player they want to go after, whether that is a Miles Turner or an OG Anunoby or Star X, who ends up hitting the market. And I think that when you consider some of the high-level talent, particularly for the Thunder with Shea and with the Pelicans with Zion, that sooner rather than later actually makes more sense. And I'm not saying Pelicans are doing they're trading 5 first-round picks this offseason or anything silly like that, but I want people to be prepared for the possibility.
So, I mean, I think the other thing that allows you to do is, like, you know, the whole storyline when the Timberwolves made the Gobert trade, it was like, wow, they did this trade and they managed to hold on to, like, all their most important players. And it was good for them to keep Jaden McDaniels, certainly. But one thing we learned is, like, actually, no, it turns out anytime you're matching that much salary, you got to give up some pretty important players. And they have badly missed Malik Beasley this season, at the very least.
And Vanderbilt.
Vanderbilt. Yeah, and even Patrick Beverley, perhaps, although not enough to bring him back in the buyout market. The fact that these teams are so deep and still have the draft picks incoming that might not be involved in a trade like this, I think makes it easier to make one without that kind of sacrifice. To me, the time is very ripe for Oklahoma City. Do you know where the Thunder rank, even after their loss last night to the Jazz, in point differential in the Western Conference?
Right now, I think they're fourth or fifth.
They are fourth in the Western Conference in point differential.
Well, and I pulled it. I was talking with, I think it was with Matt Moore on this podcast a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about the Thunder. And I believe at that point, I think it's toned down a little bit since then. They're like something like fifth in the entire league in net rating since December 1st.
Is Orlando one of the teams ahead of them?
I think they might be.
I don't know specifically. It's just those two are the, and John Hollinger wrote about this, our buddy at The Athletic earlier this week, the two teams that are really coming on right now and project to be even stronger next season. Orlando doesn't have that kind of, even though they've got the Chicago pick coming, maybe not that kind of trade draft capital, but both in very interesting spots. And yeah, you've got Oklahoma City sitting here, going to add Chet Holmgren next season. If you add one more piece, I feel like they very much could get in the mix. It could be like the Thunder of the early 2010s, how quickly they went from like, oh yeah, this is a pretty promising team. Kevin Durant, Russell Westbrook, they just drafted James Harden. Wait a second, they're in the NBA Finals already? I mean, I think that kind of, I don't know that you should expect that specifically, them making it to the finals, but that kind of leap is, I think, very much on the table for them. And I think one of the interesting questions they're going to have to answer is, like, at some point, does Lu Dort become their version of Dylan Brooks? Like, I don't think his shot selection is questionable as Dylan Brooks, but coincidentally, these two Canadians that tend to play bigger than their size defensively, since Dort is basically their four most of the time now, it could be the same thing where, you know, he had all this kind of latitude to explore the studio space offensively when they were deeply rebuilding. But when you start competing, do you start to worry a little more about some of Dort's weaknesses offensively? And does that make it more, you know, important to kind of include him in a deal like this for a guy like Ananobi, who would be an offensive upgrade in addition to just being, you know, more naturally sized for that power forward spot?
The threshold's changing so dramatically for strengths and weaknesses when you get to the higher rounds of the playoffs. It's such an adjustment for fans. Like, I think that's one of the more interesting ones as somebody who covers the whole league is, like, you see this, you know, person that you see as the golden child, like, oh, they're doing all this stuff, and then they get into one of those rounds and a lot of terrible stuff happens, like defensively or whatever. You go, oh God, they're unplayable, do all this stuff. And it can be an issue. And with Oklahoma City, there, I mean, I love that you brought up Dylan Brooks, because there is this extremely fraught place where this player was essential for you becoming what you are and getting to where you are, simultaneously not being quite good enough to be that player when you're going against the best of the best when the standards get higher. And with Dylan Brooks, part of what's so surreal about it is it's an element that isn't essential to his value. It's an element that is directly contrary to that, which is his shot selection and kind of his inability to hold back in some of those circumstances.
And, like, you could still make a case based on, I think, his RAPM remains quite strong, you know, his defensive impact, like all of that, that maybe Dylan Brooks is still that important to the Grizzlies. But, boy, just to be that inefficient offensively, it becomes a pretty big challenge when you're playing that big a role.
Briefly, because some people are like, oh, why do you always bag on Dylan Brooks and all those things? Like, okay, since his, well, we'll not count his rookie year, when actually Dylan Brooks played more minutes than any other rookie in the NBA that year. Since then, so that year he had, oh, I'll just do all of them. These are Dylan Brooks' true shooting. Some of these samples are smaller due to injury. From his rookie year on, 53, 50, 51, 52, 52. Current year, 48.
Yeah.
And Brooks is not always horrendous on the shot diet. Like, if you're just narrowing the field to the shots that are what you would consider the kind of the standard for players like him, those like catch and shoot jump shots or things like that. Like those, I think it depends a little bit year to year. From what I recall, he's been a little bit worse on those this year than his normal standard. That's a part of why his efficiency has been so horrible. But yeah, Dylan Brooks shooting 34% on catch and shoot threes even this year, but he's taking 2.1 pull-up threes per game. For reasons. Some of that, Desmond Bane not being available. That hurts things, and it made his shot diet a little less helpful. But it's a question in terms of why it's so exploitable, because if you can make life harder on Ja, you can make life harder on Bane, then you're going to make that sacrifice. You're going to live with Dylan Brooks hitting some of those threes and taking some bad ones.
I mean, I think what's probably frustrating about this, and it feels like Grizzlies fans have become especially frustrated with this, is it's not clear why you have to say that sacrifice. Because, like, to me, when I think about that sacrifice, I think about Boston playing Isaiah Thomas in the deep rounds of the playoffs. Like, obviously, that's going to limit you defensively because of his size. There's nothing he could do about it. But he's so good offensively, you know, in his prime that he made up for it. And in Dylan Brooks' case, it's not a physical limitation. It's a choice, basically. Like, obviously, there's a skill element to a degree, but you know, it's kind of like, this is playing this way is inherently what's gotten me to this point, so I have to continue doing it, which actually makes it kind of parallel to the Russell Westbrook conversation.
Oh boy. And the good news for the Clippers is that they do have other places to turn, and Russell Westbrook has not been there so long that you have to ride the train. And so maybe it works. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it will be different for them than it has been for so many teams since Russell Westbrook was the best version of himself on the court. However, almost all other iterations of Russell Westbrook could cause some real, real problems for them.
Yeah, and I think the biggest challenge to me in terms of this, like, well, there's no downside. He's playing for the minimum. It's just the time that you're going to invest in trying to integrate him into the rotation in the lineup during this stretch where, hey, you're finally healthy, you know, knock on wood, and you've got a relatively light schedule the rest of the way, might actually get to have some practices, and you've already got three other new guys to integrate that you added at the trade deadline. Like, you layer the Westbrook element on top of it, it's a lot to work through
without a lot of time. And as we brought up, if the Clippers can't push all the way up to like the three, the margin for error gets razor thin in each round, and they may have the talent to pull through, but it's a lot to ask of anybody. You watch everyone, and we have, you know, probably about 10 minutes that we can go, that we're going to go beyond this. What teams, what players intrigue you the most for this next couple weeks?
I thought you were going to point out the running joke in our group chat that whatever the worst game of the night is, that's the one that I happen to be watching.
Yeah, whatever game I have on my second TV because I haven't changed it yet is the game that you're watching primarily.
It's Nate's League Pass avert is the one that I'm watching. I mean, so besides the players that we've already, like the teams and players that we've already talked about, I guess, well, whenever Karl Anthony Towns comes back, I think Minnesota is going to immediately jump to the top of the League Pass rankings in terms of, you know, how do they reintegrate him? The fact that they've managed to hang around 500 and still be at the, you know, top of the play-in mix right now, like, does that mean that when Karl Anthony Towns comes back, they actually can be the kind of top five, top six team in the West that we expected all along? Like, that's a really fascinating question we haven't yet touched on.
I'm hopeful that the greater focus on Anthony Edwards, and you could say Edwards and Towns, like, just, you know, like how this all interplay works out, could end up benefiting them. And I think back to last year's playoffs, and for me, the best things that Minnesota was doing offensively against Memphis was when Edwards was running the show. And Mike Conley's a wonderful player. You can still lean on him, but I think he's more comfortable fitting in where he gets in than D'Angelo Russell was. And they're both flawed defensively. Especially since they can't run the same stuff that they were all of last year, like, I think Conley can do it reasonably well, and you also are probably more comfortable just straight up not playing him if that's the way things go. Yeah. You wish you had some of the functional guard depth. And with Towns, like, it sucks that they're going to have to figure this out over, who knows, 10 to 15 games before the postseason and then be thrown straight in the fire. They don't have a good enough record. I do see an avenue, especially with Edwards playing as well as he has recently, for them to push higher in this and make actually being competitive in the postseason more viable.
For sure. I think that's very much on the table. Like we haven't talked about them a lot in this podcast yet, but again, you know, I wouldn't say it's a best case scenario without Towns in the lineup, but it's, I think, a positive scenario for them to still be where they are, that this injury hasn't sunk them in the standings. Okay. The second one that we again haven't talked about, Quinn Snyder hasn't been hired in Atlanta as we record this, but all signs seem to be pointing towards Quinn Snyder taking over as the next coach of the Hawks. And that's a pretty extreme change in philosophy in terms of the value of the 3-point shot relative to long twos. It'll be interesting to see what kind of immediate changes that has.
We love to think about the significance of a coach, and I mean, there are various examples. I mean, you go the more extreme, like the change from Mark Jackson to Steve Kerr and some of the ones, but like an in-season shift that like we could see here is not unprecedented, but pretty close. And I would be very intrigued by how much we see Quinn Snyder's fingerprints if that is what ends up happening. I'll throw two other teams out there. We've mentioned both of them, but I think it bears further emphasis. One of them is the Cleveland Cavaliers. And there will be a believe it when I see it element to this, because a lot of these players have just not been in that circumstance, most notably Evan Mobley and Darius Garland. Like that, it is unfortunate that their fall at the end of last year kind of prevented us from seeing some of that, because they were so good a lot of last year. And so what is the theory of the team? Can this two-headed offensive monster, two-headed defensive monster work well? And presumably they're going to play some good teams like that. I think that's going to happen here. So they're one. And then the other one, and this is, you know, one of my compunctions, is the Orlando Magic, because
you beat me to it.
You brought up that they've been really competitive over this stretch. I think they're still going to be trying. Now, I had this theory a long time ago that they, like about a month ago, that they were closer to the bottom of the play-in mix than they were to the bottom of the East. That is already kind of coming closer to fruition because of the success that they've had recently. We'll see if that actually affects their draft seeding or if they can massage things a little bit. But it's more this question of, we know that there will be continued internal improvement from guys like Paolo Banchero and Franz Wagner and hopefully Wendell Carter as well. It becomes, are they already good, or what do they need to become that next level? Because it's looking more like this year, whether we're talking about cap space or we're talking about their draft pick, is probably their last great shot to add a second or third best player on this iteration of the Magic.
And I think the player you didn't hit on that is really crucial in that is Markel Fultz.
For sure.
And as well as he's playing, like, do you need Fred VanVleet? I happened to, like, after the fact, go back and on Synergy watch the Orlando-Toronto game from the week before the break. And I'm sure this wasn't actually a factor, but there was very much a vibe of like, Markel Fultz and Jalen Suggs are both playing great against Fred VanVleet. Like, this is very amusing, given all the talk that the Magic are ready to make a big offer to VanVleet this summer. Like, maybe they don't need him. Now, maybe they can coexist, because, I mean, part of the beauty of Markel Fultz is, like, he's got such great size at 6'6 at the point guard that, like, you put him on his opposing number and he provides you the value that a lot of teams derive from hiding a point guard somewhere else and putting their wing on a point guard. So, you know, that's part of the value that Markel Fultz is bringing to the table, and it potentially allows him to play off VanVleet. But that's to me a big one to watch. And then also, what is Jonathan Isaac? Because, like, he does not seem to have lost much athletically despite being off the court for nearly 2.5 years it was three full years almost, right? Three full years.
Because the timing of the injury, I believe you're right.
Or he had played like one or two games because he got hurt again in the bubble, but had, was just coming back from the injury he'd suffered at the start of 2020. Now that I get that straight in my head. But his like steal and block rates are still through the roof.
The other one I'll add, they've come up in passing a couple times, is the Sacramento Kings. I love watching them play. And it's funny, people, because I like didn't have Sabonis in my first group as an all-star. It's like, oh, no, I watch the Kings a lot. I enjoy watching them play. Will they be able to piece some of this together? And no matter what, this is great to build on moving forward. Thankfully, other than Harrison Barnes, pretty much all their principals are under contract, so we will get to see this team for another period of time. But they're going to get, hopefully, the reps that Cleveland didn't last year. And I'm not comparing them in terms of their long-term potential. I'm a bigger believer in what Cleveland has going than what Sacramento has. But can they put some of this together? Are we seeing enough from De'Aaron Fox, from Sabonis, from Keegan Murray to be like, okay, they'll be in the conversation moving forward.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, this is an opportunity for the Kings. I think they've got to really kind of maximize it because, you know, things have broken pretty well for them in terms of the health elsewhere in the Western Conference and their own health, knock on wood, where they've, you know, generally been able to run out their starting five pretty much every single game. I will say I was disappointed. Like, I don't think it made sense for Sacramento to make a big trade at the deadline, given where they are in the standings, because I still think they're early in their run rather than, you know, at the culmination of it. But I did think there was an opportunity for them to upgrade the backup center spot to maybe, you know, they did add Kessler and Edwards, but add a wing defender who has a chance to be part of their rotation. And I was unable to in the mock trade deadline, they did not make that move.
Broadly speaking, I think it's better for teams to be proactive and understand the thresholds. And it's a lot to ask, especially if a team hasn't been there before. And I mean, I had similar frustrations with Cleveland and the idea that doing something was better, especially for them with the Caris LeVert contract looming over things, because it's thornier for them to add that player, whoever that is, later. They are pretty asset poor. But yeah, with Sacramento, you have some pieces that are extremely exciting, and you hope that they're going to be on the roster for a long time, but you want to assess that and put the right things around them to maximize your chances, even if this isn't the only shot you're going to have.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm less convinced with Cleveland in that, look, obviously they didn't eventually have enough to get in the Josh Hart conversation since he went for a first, and if it wasn't Josh Hart, I'm not sure who they could have gotten who would have been a clear upgrade on Caris LeVert.
I hadn't thought about it that way, but I think you make a good point. And I don't know. I get frustrated watching them. I had it on a second screen for a little less than last night, but that was more my frustration with the Pelicans than it was the Raptors. I'm still kind of reeling is overstating things, but I'm still kind of grappling with their decisions at the All-Star break. Pirtle has looked very good there. Extreme. I'm happy with that. And some of the offensive stuff has been better. He's been passing the ball, all that.
Yeah, has been very noticeable. Yep.
I'm still wondering what the theory of the case is there. Is it we're better than we've been, we're going to bring this group back? Is it we don't know who we're going to bring back? And so, like, I mean, I want any semblance of signal from the Raptors moving forward, because, like, I mean, I did a whole pod with Eric Kareen about this. It's not that I can't figure them out from a, like, who they have and are they good. It's the direction and the motivation that are harder to parse.
Yeah, I think it's like, you know, them to some degree looking at the underlying numbers that, you know, they've been, you know, relatively unlucky in terms of their own shooting, that they've played better than their point differential is better than their record. You add those two things up, I think there's a solid case that, you know, they could be as high as the sixth best team in the Eastern Conference right now. I mean, maybe the fifth. Yeah, I mean, New York isn't like leaps and bounds better than them. So they could be the fifth best team in the Eastern Conference right now. And then you hope that if you bring this back and go into next season, you know, James Harden signs in Houston, something else happens, and lo and behold, we're right in the mix to not only win a playoff series, but maybe two.
Masai's been right before. I wonder how it's going to go. And then the other variable there, which they're going to have to deal with very soon, is not only do you have to deal with what these players choose to do, and so Fred VanVleet, Gary Trent Jr., a year later, OG Anunoby, can choose to take their talents elsewhere, and presume, like, depending on the offers and everything else. It's also the ramifications, and I mean, just as a CBA cap nerd, Masai Ujiri's negotiating by basically getting players at a lower annual value, as I would interpret it based on the contracts they signed, lower annual value in exchange for a player option is a really notable gambit, because it allows you to put kind of more talent together in the short term, but it also puts free agency earlier. And that either means that the players are getting higher price tags or they're getting out, and it might work. Like, we will get more clear information on that concept now than we have had before, but I really want to see how it works out.
And I think the key to that strategy is you have to actually get the lower price point. Like, with Anunoby, I feel like pretty confidently you can feel like that was a great value for them. Gary Trent Jr., what I didn't like about that contract is it seemed like market value for him at the time, plus he got the player option after 2 years. I thought that was a great contract from Trent's standpoint. That, you know, Clutch, which also has been, I think, pretty, you know, aggressive about demanding player options in their players' contracts, negotiated for him.
Anything else that's sticking out to you that you're going to be tracking, whether it's rest of the year or next couple weeks?
I think we pretty much covered it here.
I think for me, the last thing I'll mention is sorting out the bottom of the West. And we're dealing, you know, we talked about how at the very beginning of this podcast, how there's not that much left. It's a little over 20 games for each team. And is it going to be 13 squads pushing to the finish line for the last 3 weeks? Is it going to be more like 11 or 12? Who falls out and why? Because the why might be you're not good enough. Like, for especially if the Blazers, like if you know, Simons is missing time, if Nurk ends up missing more time as well, like that could end up being a factor here. Or is it that you had an injury and these teams are all putting heat on everyone else? And so surprising teams not only miss out on the play-in, but also are just in much tougher position.
It also might be there's a blizzard in Portland, so you get stuck on the runway overnight, basically, and aren't able to land until 3 hours before the game.
For sure. Ugh. Well, thank you so much for taking time. Always a pleasure, my friend.
Likewise, thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Kevin Pelton for taking the time to come on. You can, of course, read his excellent work at ESPN, does both NBA and WNBA, does some really good work there. I am, as always, completely impressed with his bandwidth, the hardest working person in NBA media, in my humble opinion. And that means you can also listen to him on various ESPN platforms. I always love to see and hear him there. You can also listen to the fabulous Pelton Cast, the podcast that he does. And if you don't already, you can follow him on Twitter at kpelton, K-P-E-L-T-O-N. Love having him on. And the stretch run being so close is just striking this year, and so many teams that were still figuring all this stuff out. And that means there's a lot more to do, a lot more to see, but it's a lot of fun too. And I mean, I got so excited. I was watching games on Thursday, just like, oh, figuring all this stuff out. That in particular, that Cavs Denver game was fascinating. I thought Mobley looked really good, but also, you know, lots of fun throughout. The Thunder Jazz game also stood out. If you want to support this show, there are a lot of different things you can do. You can subscribe, download every episode. That really is useful for Real GM Radio because it's never going to come out on a specific day of the week. It's my availability, my guest's availability, so you can't get in a habit. So if you subscribe and download, you don't have to. It'll do it for you. Whatever podcast player you use, really do appreciate that. You can also help other people find the show. Word of mouth, rating and review in podcast player, social media, however you want to do that. Help other people find the show. We appreciate it. But the single most important thing you can do for this podcast and any other that has them is to check out our sponsors for this episode. That is betonline.ag. Use the CLNS50 promo code to give yourself a 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. That should be the main reason you do it. Ancillary reason, it tells them that you came from us, and hopefully you will continue to advertise on this podcast. You can also check out my other work. Now that our vacation is done, Nate and I are going strong with Dunked On and Dunked On Prime. 15 and 60 will be back on Sunday. We're figuring out how we're going to handle that with the teams that we want to cover in a short week, but we're working through that. Also, of course, doing gamers and doing news and everything else, and also the great content. Pelton mentioned that Dan Feldman is doing the Daily Dunks, which is great, and Seth Partnow is doing Nerd Notches, and then also the podcast that Nate does with John Hollinger. We're also coming back with a vengeance on the NBA strategy stream. We are doing two games in the next few days. We're going to be broadcasting on Saturday, Indiana Pacers, Orlando Magic. That is a 7 Eastern, 4 Pacific start. Then next week, we're doing Tuesday and Friday. Tuesday, Sacramento at Oklahoma City. That's an 8 Eastern, 5 Pacific start. And then Knicks Heat, we're doing that on Friday. That's going to be, we don't usually do Friday broadcasts, but we're going to do that one. 8 Eastern, 5 Pacific. So you can check all those out. You can also ask questions. Honestly, you can ask them now using the hashtag NBA strategy stream. We get to those live on air. Was just doing some of my prep for the Indiana-Orlando game before recording with KP. Also written work at The Athletic. I have my team-by-team breakdown, and I have a couple other things in process now. I was actually thinking during my time off about how I want to order these, and I'll talk to editorial as well. So hopefully I'll get moving on that in the next couple days, depending on when I have time to write. Going to be watching a whole lot of basketball games. And if you have any feedback, good, bad, or indifferent, DannyLarueNBA@gmail.com is the way to get to me. If you take the time to write it, I will take the time to read it. That is an absolute promise. I'm not the greatest at replying, but I try. But that's why reading it, it's feedback more than anything else. And that is all for now. So thank you so much for listening. Take care and make it a great day.